Ok, tiếc xin giao gì đó em chơi chuyện ngủ rồi nó chuyện ngủ rồi em rồi giao đó quen em dòng bà mẹ bà mẹ mẹ bà mẹ quen giao làm mà em bớt. Giờ là có xong kỳ bà chuyện bà con này cho anh giao chẳng chấp dụng cho bà chuyện chứ làm đó rồi. Anh đang giao chỉ cần đồng nhầm này anh quen anh giao chỉ để chẳng làm em quen. Trên chiến sĩ tại vì là mẹ là sợ đồ anh đề đó rồi đồ bà lỡ nà chú là lúc đó và tổ bà rực sinh dịu lỡ đồ anh nằm khá đồng nhầm bà xem chẳng đồng. Thu xếp là nà mẹ bà nằm rục tên dịu đề và tổ bà xong dịu dịu gồm phong rừng bộ chìm chồng như tổ bà rực sá. Ok, well, since we are going to do some more sitting meditation this afternoon, and first I will say some things that help us to do sitting meditation. And in general, I think when we start practice meditation, it's important to develop the shamatha practice, the quality of the mind. Normally, we do not pay attention to our mind and let our mind wandering all over and let our mind arise so many different conceptual thoughts. Therefore, when we sit down and try to make our mind calm and quiet, it is so hard and so distracted, almost impossible to focus on meditation even 1 second. So thoughts come one after another, and then it makes us too discourage to do the sitting meditation. Therefore, all of us having hard time to do sitting meditation. And then a lot of us prefer to say like, okay, I want to do more mindfulness practice, or I want to just make my life into Dharma and spiritual. So everything, what I do and what I say and it's easy to say that, but until we really make our mind become more flexible and tame the mind, it is really hard to have that kind of skill to use every single actions we take as a Dharma. So therefore, sitting meditation is so important. When we do the sitting meditation, the point we do sitting meditation is connecting our body and speech mind one pointedly. And not letting our mind distract and go all over. And but it's not that easy to connect our body, speech, mind. Because we have not really working on our body, speech, mind, and connecting body, speech, mind. Therefore, it's hard to connect those three things at the one spot and one time. So, sit the quality of sitting meditation, or I would like to say yoga of mind, the quality of yoga of mind or meditation based on the quality of mind is always rely upon the speech and the body. So if we know how to sit, and if we are really used to work with our postures, and that helps us the quality of our meditation. It is much easier for us to work with our mind.
and mental activity, because of the posture, mental activity is not that too agitated. So mind can be relaxed pretty easily. So it's so important to know the sitting posture. And also, if we have been working with our breath or speech, without breath or wind energy, we are not capable to speak and have the voice. Therefore, breathing is so important. So posture helps us to be able to breathe naturally. And when we are being able to breathe naturally, that helps us the quality of mind, and mind is not going to be that distracted. So those three things are always important. There is a story. A Hinayana, a realized Hinayana practitioner, and in Buddhist we call it Arhati, and went to some yogis who are in the forest, but the conduct of those yogis were so weird. Some were just sleeping all the time, some were just completely crazy, and some were to do so many different things, and he saw that, and he has been watching them, but that forest was so huge and there were so many monkeys. And then, of course, monkeys sometimes sit like a meditator. And those yogis who were like not practicing, who did not have any meditation instructions, but they saw the posture of monkeys sitting like this, really straight, the body posture. And those weird yogis, or like those people who were thinking they were practitioners, they were acting like monkeys and sitting like monkeys. The posture really helped them. They found a peaceful feeling from the posture. Okay? So those wild people started, like one after another, was telling, like, wow, that was so good. If you sit like this, the quality of a breath and a quality of a mind is so peaceful. And everybody started just working with that posture and the way monkeys were sitting. And those people were not exact Buddhists, but they really obtained some realization based on the posture. So posture is so important. But this is since a yoga studio, and a lot of you have been doing a lot of yoga. So if we do not have to worry about our posture, and if we know how to sit, and if we can sit effortlessly, then it helps the quality of breath, the quality of mind. So important. So I encourage you to get used to that sitting posture. Sit straight, so important. And then that will naturally helps the breath. And whenever breath becomes natural and soft, then our mind is not going to be that agitated. We won't have so many conceptual thoughts. So if we start from here and work with posture, work with breath, and then quality of mind is going to be much better than ordinary days. And also it is easy for us to develop shamatha practice. Okay, one-pointedness. Developing shamatha practice is so important. If we develop shamatha practice, at one point, we won't have any trouble to sit, and we won't have any trouble to connect body and breath and mind. And also, we won't have a lot of disturbing thoughts and agitations arise from mind because of our shamatha practice is improving or good. But the thing is, in the West, when we hear shamatha practice, we completely think one narrow idea about shamatha practice. Just focus and then like one-pointedly. We can use shamatha practice any kind of Buddhist techniques. Breathing practice, for example. That is shamatha practice. If you one-pointedly focus on breath, that is shamatha practice. And bodhicitta practice, if you one-pointedly focus on bodhicitta practice, that becomes shamatha practice. And compassion practice, if you really one-pointedly work with compassion and try to generate compassion all the time and maintain that energy of compassion and one-pointedly work with compassion, that is shamatha practice. And loving-kindness and rejoicing and so many different techniques that we have in Tibetan Buddhist or general Buddhist tradition. We can use any method as a shamatha practice, as a develop the quality of our ordinary mind. So the thing is, when we are sitting, we try to make an effort to focus either bodhicitta, compassion, breath, one-pointedly. Not let any other thoughts corrupt the one-pointedness or that focusing on one-pointedly on what? Breath or compassion, loving-kindness. If we make effort and not let any other conceptual thoughts corrupt our focus and one-pointedness practice or shamatha, and then slowly we can habituate not having so many thoughts. And we can sit straight and working with the breath, and also we can come abiding or work with the shamatha practice. But practitioners in 21st century, we do not really make effort to build the foundation of our meditation practice. We just receive the teachings about shamatha, about compassion, loving kindness, or bodhicitta. But we do not make effort to develop those practices, but we want to achieve some other realization, which is much difficult than shamatha or beginner practices. So foundation is so important. Therefore, meditators in 21st century are having hard time making their mind quiet and not having so many conceptual thoughts because of our shamatha practice or foundation practice is not advanced or it's not good enough to do it. When I was so young, I would say so young, yeah, maybe 7-8 years old, my childhood Lama, Chimpar Lama, who was recognized me as a reincarnated Lama, I don't know about that, but since I was 7-8, I started meditating with him. The only thing he taught me was working with the posture, breath, and shamatha. As a young kid, 7 years old, it was so hard even sit for 10, 15, 20 minutes. But he didn't let me get up. And he was like a rock when he was sitting. He did not have to move. He did not have to breathe or I don't know. So I sat with him for months, and at least an hour, 2 hours a day. So think, I started working with spiritual practice since I was 7. And I have been developing my sitting meditation, quality of my sitting meditation, and of course, posture, wind energy, and the quality of the mind since then. So I would say 36 years has passed. I'm still working on that. I'm still developing. I do not have to make effort and develop my sitting like a posture and not breathing practices anymore. But sometimes still I have conceptual thoughts here and there in the corners. Conceptual thoughts are really tricky. And when you feel, my meditation is good, and then that conceptual thought comes up and corrupts the practice. So just think, I hope this will help you, or maybe this will discourage you to put a lot of energy on your spiritual practice. But I was just exactly like North Americans who just start doing the practice. Restless. Physically, I was restless. And mentally, I was restless. And I was really talkative. And wanted to say so many things, or sing songs, or jump, or so many things. But if you really commit this path and practice, except when I give teachings, I do not have a lot of ordinary conversations. That is getting a little bit of a problem. So when I'm with really ordinary people, I don't know sometimes what to talk about. But when our practice is improving, and every single actions become more and more pure and more positive, and negative speeches become fewer and fewer, and negative thoughts, of course, become fewer, then bodhicitta and positive, excellent motivations become stronger and stronger. So we just need to work and put a little bit of effort on our sitting meditation and breathing practice, and then examine our mental activities. So first we need to make effort. And then later, when you really get used to it, everything becomes natural. And when you're sitting, your body, speech, mind almost become one. And there's no separation. And you can completely do the sitting meditation. And when you finish the sitting meditation, also because of your you habituated the spiritual practice, when you're getting off the cushion, so easy to take, to bring that energy into your daily life. So I think develop shamatha practice is so important, one of the most important thing. And also, since Michael was asking and about generosity practice, generosity practice seems so important in the West. Okay. Why I said in the West? In Asia, East, generosity is not a problem. That doesn't mean their generosity is pure. And their generosity is a parameter of generosity in six paramitas, among six paramitas. But giving is not a problem for Asians because of Buddhist culture. But there is a problem about generosity in Asia, really, really contaminated by affective emotions. So that's not that healthy, but giving is not a problem. But in the West, it seems being a generous person seems so hard. Western famous people are pretty generous, but their motivation is, I'm not sure, really pure, without hope, or without any like returning. 99%, I would say, have a hope, and become more popular. All people think he or she did amazing. Like. So that's happening in Asia, but normally Western people are having to be generous and to giving things. So there are a couple ways to practice paramita of generosity or general generosity practice, I would say. Paramita of generosity has to be really advanced. Giving small things without any attachment, without any hope. Okay, I'm giving this and I hope he or she will return something. Three or four ways we can practice generosity. The most simple generosity practice, which is giving things, giving wealth. That is the most easy the easiest generosity practice. But for a lot of us, it is the hardest generosity practice. Giving things are so hard because we have fears, we have doubts, we might lose things. And we might not have enough things. But giving is, for me, it seems so good for my self-attachment and greedy, feeling of greedy, being greedy and stinginess. Okay, I have stories. I never had a problem to give things when I was in Tibet because I never had a lot of things. And since I left Tibet, also for a while, I didn't have a lot. And when we went to Japan, Alison and I moved to Japan. Japan is one of the most expensive country in the world. So we didn't have enough, and we were a little bit worried. And we were not giving, and we really worried about wealth and the financial. But at one point, I really got tired of it. And I decided to give away 45% of income. Completely give away, either make offerings for lamas or Tibetan people's education, whoever needed, whoever asked. And since I made that promise, and I started to giving, I felt much better. I felt I was not as attached to myself as before. So, practice generosity and giving is helping really your mental poverty. We human beings developed that mental poverty and we feel I don't have enough and I don't have enough. So therefore we cannot give, we cannot practice generosity. Since then, I have been keeping my promise. I really just, but especially like this year, I would say more than 50% of things I get, I gave away. That helps the desire, attachment. That helps to tame our self-attachment. And that helps us not worry about wealth a lot. So, but I'm not saying you should, okay, get rid of your wealth. I'm not saying that. But the point is, we should examine our mind, how strong our mental poverty is. So we need to work on that. Be generous, but you do not have to give huge things. But it's really good to learn the giving. Sometimes we are too tight. It's hard even give a cup of a coffee for someone. On one hand, it's expensive. Coffee seems expensive in Canada, though. So maybe it's not that easy for you guys. But coffee is not that expensive in Denver. But the thing is, the giving is, we should give completely from a positive and motivation, not like giving things for selfish reasons. This is one way to practice generosity. If you feel generosity practice is important, I think it's good to train that way and start from giving some small things. And also, we can be generous our service. That is a really good generosity practice. For example, when I come to Ottawa, I'm not praising Sarah though, but her massages are so helpful, seriously. And she offered me to do massage. That is a generosity practice. And if you have different skills to serve others from your really deep inside of your mind, have that pure motivation and offer that service for others, for the community, for the Sangha. That's the generosity practice. Okay, this is a good thing. We have a group here, right, in Ottawa. Sometimes Sangha members are so selfish and do not want to help and support. This year is a little bit better. Otherwise, whenever I come, David is everything. David have to come up so many things, space, including this. It's not like a really nice chair, but including this chair. And tankas and everything. And the people just watch the back of David, but not giving the time and energy. Why? Because we are really selfish. But you can give and support. That is generosity practice. Offering the service is generosity practice. So that's the thing. Maybe this will bother David, but you guys, Canadians, are so into union, right? That social idea is sometimes you like just to watch and have something is completely prepared and you want to enjoy, but you do not really be a part and support. But he's not that agree with me. But the thing is, in Tibet we have a saying, when someone is cooking, we like to watch the cooking and like to eat the food, prepared food, but we do not like to participate and offer the service and support. So Sangha is the same thing. Small group in Ottawa, small group in Montreal. Each Sangha members has responsibility of that Sangha. And each Sangha members generously serve the Sangha. And that Sangha is going to be healthier and stronger, and Sangha will help so many other practitioners. But every single Sangha members back off and put everything on one or two or three people's shoulder, responsibility on a couple people's shoulder, and cannot become a like really healthy organization. So I would like encourage you, do generosity practice and serve the group, serve the Sangha, and serve the society. What whatever talent you have, and if that helps the society, the community, and really without attachment and serve. This can be a really good generosity practice for you. So this is not really included the generosity teachings in Tibetan Buddhist tradition. But I have been teaching this and asking people to serve and the Sangha and the community generously. It seems so important for Western Sanghas and the Western community. We like to do volunteer works, right? Volunteer work is one of best generosity practice. If we know how to practice generosity, if we know bodhicitta practice, if we know, examine the motivation, and if we have a good motivation and do volunteer work, it is generosity practice. And then I move to second way to do generosity practice. But I will just say several things about it. Otherwise, I do not think any of us can do this generosity practice. Why? Because when you really develop your generosity practice based on like giving things, then at one point, those bodhisattvas, they're really, really realized, and they can even give a part of their body if someone needs it, even life. So none of us can do that. And I don't think you should try to do it. Sure. Yeah. Do, yes. But I'm not sure the motivation. So it is amazing motivation to do it. I have not decided to donate a part of my body yet, because I wanted to make sure my motivation is completely pure. But Allison, she already did when she was really young, and I did not make any obstacles for that, but I tell her all the time, you have to have a really strong bodhicitta to be able to give a part of your physical body when your outer breath ceases. Or if you are a donor, maybe even your outer breath is not ceased. Mm-hmm. So your meditation and practice has to be so, so good. And you have to be a completely selfless person. Otherwise, if you regret about it, can cause some maybe problems. I'm not encourage you donate your parts. But the thing is, if you are a person who's brave enough to give some parts of your physical body, it's amazing. I'm really rejoiced. But top of that, if you practice in bodhicitta, and you really develop that bodhicitta practice, and when someone is taking your part, and if your bodhicitta practice is so stable, and you can rejoice and dedicate the parts you gave for others, the merit of that practice is incredible and so amazing. Okay, that's the second. If you are a person who already donated, practice Dharma, and especially tame your ego and self-attachment, then your donation is going to be a perfect paramita of a generosity practice. And then third is giving Dharma. It is a generosity practice. So, just think, we all have a different techniques or different qualities, and to help others, and to try to do your best and help others, that is a generosity practice. That is the service we can use as a generosity practice. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, I think that's good. If you want to practice generosity, then first start support the Sangha selflessly. And then also you can support the community selflessly. Then you can slowly develop your generosity practice. We still have one more weekend, but I really encourage all of you who are participating the sanghas. You have been participating and also you have been supporting, but try to maintain. This is a bodhisattva activity, and you're practicing bodhicitta. And if you support the group, and then directly it's helping yourself, and also indirectly it's helping other people who come to the Sangha. It's important for you and for also the community and for the Sangha. And some of you are, you have been practicing Vajrayana and the Dharma for a number of years. Don't be snobby, and don't think, oh, I am not like, I already graduated from the book group or reading a book. Then that's the sign you have not graduated. You're completely beginner. Oh, I want to like deepen my meditation, and I don't know, it's just a discussion, it's so boring. That means you're not really ready, and you work that side of your personality and be compromised. If you have been practicing Dharma for a number of years, you should be the leader, you should be the example for other new Sangha members. You're not the example for others to see a snob, big-headed Dharma practitioner. Well, I know better, and this is just stupid. Then you're wrong. I'm sorry, but you're wrong. And if you're a newcomer and new to spiritual practice, you came to the group. The reason is you wanted to develop your spiritual practice, and you want to improve your precious human life. You want to be a better person. Therefore, you should try to develop your personality, try to change your personality spiritually. But a lot of us, when we come into spiritual groups, and our personality become so critical. Oh, this is so religion. This is so, just difficult. Oh, this is just like a Catholic church. Or this is just like Jewish church. You did not, from the first place, you didn't come to the group based on a critical mind. You wanted to come to develop your spiritual practice. Again, tell yourself, be patient. Some things are too weird for you. But try to not be critical. And try to use things that help your personality, your spiritual practice. And slowly, you will understand more, and the spiritual practice will help you more. So, middle ground is so important. When I lead Sangha in Denver and the U.S., I always try to bring both, try to not let both beginners and advanced practitioners to fall into extremes. Be the middle. Middle way is so good. And balance is so good. Compromise is so good. That is the bodhisattva activity. From the beginning of this text until the end is about how to balance, how to be flexible, how to understand each other. It's so important for Sangha. It is so important for organizations. If everyone understand each other and everyone want to be balanced, the Sangha is going to be healthier. Community is going to be healthier. Community is going to be warmer and warmer. So I do not be here. I'm not like saying I'm so special and important and powerful. But I encourage my students in Denver, every single public talk that I give, and I remind them, remember bodhicitta. And try to not be self-centered. So people who come to the Sangha, they always say, Rinpoche, these people are so good. What's going on? Like, so warm. And I tell them. And then they say, like, you're an amazing teacher. I tell them, no, it's not me. It's actually them. They listen to me. And they really work on bodhicitta practice. That's why you can feel the warmth of the Sangha and warmth of the group. So, until now, both groups are really good, and maintain that, and remember those several little bit direct words. And just remember the bodhicitta and compromised. That's so important. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you guys are lucky, though. I don't live in Ottawa. If I live in Ottawa, you have to hear this constantly. Unless you want to leave the group. But twice a year you hear this, it's okay. I think you can take that. Okay, and I will take some questions and then we will do the practice.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about offering the body as generosity practice, mm-hmm. I thought of pregnancy. Would that not be an offering of the body because there's so much attachment?
You have a craving, right? You are not like satisfied even you have a Luca and you want one more. That's a joke. But whenever there is attachment, it's not a pure generosity, right? Yeah. But I don't think of pregnancy is over. No, but you can. You might. From tantric point of view, yes, you can. But what's that?
Training, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. You have to have some like a strong compassion and loving kindness. Otherwise, it's hard to take care of a baby in 21st century, right? I do not have, enough compassion and loving kindness to have a baby because it seems so hard. Sure, I can take him. That's a generosity practice.
For me or for you?
For you. If you can truly give a Luca to me, that's really without any attachment. Can you do that? We can.
There's a type of generosity, the generosity of the heart that doesn't have anything to do with actual giving and thinking about it, and neither expecting a fringe benefit nor not expecting a return. The generosity of the heart of a mother whose house is burning down and she runs back in to fetch the child. The generosity of a person who's with a group and they're in a swamp and they're all getting stuck in the swamp and drowning, and who by his or her own effort draw themselves out to the shore and they're goodbye guys, if you just work hard enough you can come out. The person with the generosity of the heart doesn't even think about it. Goes back and helps the others out of the swamp. The Good Samaritan, who is a Christian example, doesn't think about the good that he's going to do. That is generosity of the heart. Generosity of the heart is not taking credit where you really don't deserve credit. Generosity of the heart is also acknowledging and taking pride when it is your duty. We think of generosity in terms of monetary or volunteer effort. That's not all that is the part of generosity. You talked about the Asians and how giving is not a problem for them, but there is something wrong with the generosity. I'm still thinking about that. Is it because supporting the monastery and the lamas gives them the fringe benefit of being in the grace of the Buddha's merit? We call it merit in Buddhism, right? This idea of gaining merit versus the generosity of the heart. I mean,
what do you mean generosity of the heart?
We have been dealing with this in terms of we are busily accumulating, gaining merit with our practice, our solid practice.
No, I didn't get the meaning of what is the generosity of the heart. I never heard that.
It is a non-calculated generosity that comes naturally from good nature, and you call that good nature bodhicitta. That is how I see one aspect and an important one of bodhicitta.
Sure, it is. But not many of us can do that perfectly. Therefore, we have to start somewhere to develop the generosity, right? So most of us, including myself, when we're giving things, we have a little bit of hope. We always have that self-attachment. We always have that ego, right? I do. But when I truly wanted to giving things that make me happier, and if things, when I'm helping Tibetan kids, for example, directly I can feel the happiness of their education. I can feel it. And also, even though I'm not hoping I need something in return, but that part of my generosity practice is helping me rejoice. So I don't know, I never heard that generosity of a heart, but probably it's the language problem, but I don't think so many of us really have that kind of capacity. And most of us are not capable of reach that kind of level. Yeah. But of course some of us probably do.
I think it comes naturally.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. It's good. I'm not saying like you cannot generate that kind of generosity practice. But sometimes, be honest, we think we can, but if we really examine, there is a hidden ego and hidden self-attachment back there, which we cannot see.
Rinpoche, maybe an example, I'm just thinking in your case of where somebody risks their own life to save somebody else. If they risked their life to pull people out of the swamp, and the people who came out of the swamp brushed them off and said, you know, get out of my life, would that person who saved them really feel completely okay with that, or would they say, hey, wait a minute, I just saved your life, you know, have, you know.
Hopefully they'd be okay with that.
But that's the point, right? I mean, there are people who would put themselves in harm's way for others, but which is wonderful, but it's not a pure thing unless they are completely unattached to it, to the point that if they're vilified afterwards for doing something, they would be totally fine with that. That would be hard. If I put myself out there and saved somebody's life and they told me to, you know, F off, I'd probably have a problem with that.
So that's human, I think we all would.
But that's the difference, right? Mm-hmm. That's not pure motivation. Mm-hmm. You're expecting at least gratitude in return. Because that would be. So it would not be pure.
If I save Sheila,
yeah.
And if you like act something like rude to me,
yeah,
in the future, I do.
Yeah.
Oh, I saved you.
Yeah.
But at that moment, probably I don't, because I was completely focusing to saving you. But if later, if you do something rude to me, I would think, or even I say, I really saved your life. Why are you doing this to me? It's just part of human nature, right?
That's why
ego is somewhere there. We don't see. It's really.
But did you cultivate that instinct when, like, because Allison was telling me that you took, that a pillar fell on you, that you intervened so somebody else didn't lose their life, and caused you a lot of suffering in your body. Is that some, that was the flesh instinct, but you had to cultivate to get that quick reaction?
I don't think I had what to do that. Seriously, I don't think so. But I didn't want to hurt my friends.
So some sort of bodhicitta, but based on attachment. I don't want to hurt my friends.
It did hurt me, but I did not regret about it. And it still hurts. That's why you say, like, I need to probably get a massage, even like so many times. But I don't know. It's the thing is, I was saying is, if the bodhicitta, pure bodhicitta is there, then maybe what Rosemary was saying, that like a heart of a generosity, it's like a completely pure. But that doesn't mean later I can maintain that forever because of my self-attachment. But if I save Sheila, I will never see her again. I don't want to. I want to see you more, for example, right? If I don't see you anymore, then maybe. But that's also completely different situation. That doesn't mean my bodhicitta and generosity is perfect because we don't have that interaction anymore. Therefore, there's no any other negative things come up.
I don't have a question, I have a remark. Listening for yesterday class and today and questions. What I understood, because I'm originally from Russia, so I didn't grow up in that society. So, and I also observed Tibetan lamas, how they teach us and the way how they think. And I also compare how the Westerners think. So what I think comes up one main point, especially related to the cheetah. It's so important to know where you are in that particular moment. Because from the teachings I understood, that it's so important not to push yourself too much, because otherwise you'll have regrets. But because you develop it in some particular moment, you're on that stage. Then later you're there. So for example, we are not able to act as bodhisattvas now. So it's important not to act as bodhisattvas. So if we can give a little bit, this is for us, without regret, this is good for it. But then maybe 2 years or 3 years later, we are capable to do it more. This is a progress. But I do find that, as maybe I understood, the Tibetan lamas always look at the position where you are at that particular moment. What is your capacity in that particular moment? Don't push yourself to do more in that moment, but be where you are, but be very kind of solid and do that. Not just thinking, oh, I will do it later. No, just right now, what you have is your capacity to do it now. And then continue, just increase it, build up. But she corrected me if I'm wrong.
Is that a question or is that an answer?
Could you respond, which I understood how Tibetans.
I don't think it's bad. And I think if you really can develop slowly that way, I think it's good. Because some things we can do it. And then if we try too much, we end up, we cannot do anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should do things that we can do. If our expectation is so high, because of that expectation, cause us more obstacles, I think. Yeah. Okay. Well. Okay, yeah. Can you make it a little bit simple? For example, like...
Is violence ever justified?
Violence means like...
Fighting if somebody is massacring a group of innocent people, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
To protect them.
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the of course, motivation, right? And also, it depends on how many people or how many beings you can save. If you can save 100 people or hundreds of people or hundreds of beings and hundreds of lives, even if you hurt or upset a few of beings, I think from Bodhisattva teachings and path point of view, it's better to save hundreds of lives, right? So you're saving a big group of lives. And but if you just focus on like a bodhicitta and too narrow-minded, I cannot do anything because I'm bodhisattva, then really you're not following the path. So it's better to save the bigger group, even though your action is so a little bit negative, but still your motivation mind is really pure. You completely want to save if this small group can hurt thousands of people. For example, like a really, really crazy person come in and want to kill so many people. It's better to save the people who are in that place, even though you have to really attack or do things to stop that person. Yeah, I think. And in Buddhist Bodhisattva teachings also teach like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think?
It's something I'll admit that's a question for my father again.
Good. That's a good question, yeah. People ask those questions, but until maybe this past year, I did not really directly answer. Because sometimes people can be so sensitive, right? They can have like negative thoughts about Buddha Dharma. So, oh, no, like you have to treat everybody like just equally. But sometimes we need to be skillful means is that, like, right? You need to really know how to facing the situation at that moment. If someone is coming in and want to kill all of us, I hope no one is coming, but I would jump there and just try to stop. Mm-hmm.
Can we say also by going and stopping the guy, we are also helping him committing negative karma. So we are stopping him also. So we are helping him too.
Sure.
So it's a double commission.
Sure.
It?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. We're going to practice though. Uh-huh.
I've heard you say before and I heard a little bit today.
Mm-hmm.
Where you said even if you don't have pure motivation, practicing generosity, it's a start.
Yes.
So even if you're holding on to the dollar and, you know, it's a start.
Exactly.
And yet I heard you also say today with the example of giving away body parts,
mm-hmm.
that you suggested not giving it away until there was pure motivation. So I'm confused. In one case, you say, even if there's not pure motivation.
I don't think you got it.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
Sure.
If I said that, I already stopped Allison, right? She's the donor, right? But I encourage her to develop her bodhicitta.
Afterwards.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right? It's really good to do that. Really special. But develop your bodhicitta. and your generosity is just completely perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You're saying vegetarian, being vegetarian is good?
I'm asking if there's a viewpoint from
the perspective. Of course. Well, all Buddhist teachings, if you harm a tiny sentient being, that is not good, right? But there's a weird idea that Buddhists have. Maybe I would say maybe Tibetan Buddhists. Tibetan Buddhists, most of them are not vegetarian. One reason, altitude. We cannot survive. And that the meat is like generations and generations, we only had that food. So whenever we stop eating meat, really get sick. So from spiritual point of view, well, if you want to really maintain spiritual practice, you have to be healthy, right? Then we use that and make an excuse. I am Tibetan, and my body cannot really accept vegetarian food, and I have to eat meat, and we eat too much. But even His Holiness Dalai Lama, maybe now he's eating more vegetarian, but he stopped eating meat for a while. His health was so, so bad. So there's another way of thinking in Tibet when we eat meat. Some Tibetan lamas only eat meat, animals who died naturally. No one killed. So we eat those meat. But meat is not as good as normal, like meat. So being vegetarian is so special and so important. And when you also enter some Vajrayana teachings, sometimes for substance, we have to have a small meats. But of course, being vegetarian is so, so, so good, so important. Right now in Tibet, a lot of young Tibetans becoming vegetarian because there's access to buy more vegetables, and a lot of them. But also a lot of them have a lot of health problems. So it's something really important. And then also in Bodhisattva teachings, right? We say we do not want harm even a small sentient being. So it's really important. Be vegetarian. Good. Okay, let's do some practice. Then you might have some time to ask questions, but when we do sitting meditation, if you have been sitting for a long time, you might already recognize that. But when we do not have to pay attention or make effort on our posture, if our physical body is unmovable, then naturally our channels are unmovable. And when our channels are not channels are unmovable, then actually our gaze, even our eyes, do not have to move. But examine when thoughts come up. you feel you need to like do this, and you move your eyes a lot. But when you're really resting and connecting body, speech, mind, you do not have even move your eyes. So, yeah, posture is so important. Okay, so we have 10 minutes. If it's like a really exciting discussion or question, we should have some questions and an answer, and then have a joke, and then close the class. Okay?
I don't think it's exciting, but it's about posture. Okay. The body during practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading in the Tibetan yoga breath that the full lotus is the best, and if you can't do that, then...
Half a lotus, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The alternative. And what happens when, like for me, it's okay for about 20 minutes, and then one foot falls asleep,
yeah.
And then a lot of pain comes.
Yeah.
So what do you recommend?
Yoga. Seriously. And then this is not opening, right? A lot of you sit on the chair a lot. This is not opening. Therefore, you are really a lot of weight or whatever pressure is having one part of your leg. Therefore, your like nerve and your leg is falling asleep. But if we really try to open and get used to the half part, like a sattva posture, then it will help. And until I recommend you, maybe one of your leg is really easy. You can almost even, right? Yeah. And one side is not easy for you. So you might want like to put something is soft under your leg, which side is a little bit sensitive. And when you do the sattva posture, when you do this, the knee is a little bit up, right? That is making your leg fall asleep. So if you put a huge pillow, but something under the knee until you used to it, and try to make a goal until one point you don't need any pillows under the knee, then you can really sit. Without effort. And then also one more thing is in Vajrayana Buddhist tradition or in the book says like female and right in, left out, like this, right? Yeah.
Or like this.
Sure, you can do that.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you always sit like this, this part of your hip gets this. I have been sitting like that a lot, like sattva posture. One of my hip or one of my leg is like so, I don't know, it's not even. So since I met David, I realized, he did not tell me, but I realized my hip is like this, almost. So I started to like take turns, right? One session, like male sattva posture, and one session, female sattva posture, and that will balance. Mm-hmm, sure.
But I alternate every day.
Mm-hmm.
On even days, 3, 4, 6, a month, whatever, I put up right on top of how days to put up
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty exciting question.
the most important thing about the posture is the straight
spine. is so important. Of course, that everything, if you could, that's good. But spine, and then if you like this, and your shoulder naturally goes back, right? It helps your posture, like you do not have to make a lot of effort. And then gaze is so important. No. Mm-hmm.
This angle of this is a bit too much, that's right. Of this seat, if we lean to the seat like mine, or all the seats like this, it's a bit angled. It should be straight.
Straight is better.
It's better like
yeah.
This.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I can't, I always feel a cushion because I can't, I go
that's,
down my feet.
That's fine. I think that's fine.
Is it okay like
yeah.
That?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But make sure your spine is straight and shoulders back. Oh. Good. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
Ideas around yoga, and because I know they have the idea of the channel.
Mm-hmm.
That first is that yoga people.
Mm-hmm.
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 So are they
connected, of course. Yeah. Yoga tradition and Vajrayana yoga tradition and Hinduism yoga tradition, of course they're related. And a lot of yoga techniques or postures, Indian yoga practitioners can find, which they don't have among Tibetan yoga teachings. And also some yoga teachings, for example, first translator and Lozawa, Bairozana, Padmasambhava, received this Yantra Yoga teachings from Hungara in Nepal, Parbin in Nepal. And then he brought that tradition to Tibet and he taught to Bairozana. And there's 108 yoga postures. And I think it has 75 outer puppetry postures, inner 25, and then more inner or secret puppetry postures, and then rest of is actual, yantra yoga postures. So these outer, especially among outer, we can find those postures. A lot of those postures from Indian yoga tradition, even today.
How about the six yogas of Dharmapada?
Well, it's a yoga. Okay? Yoga can have outer and secret, more secret yoga practice, right? I would say that, yeah. But some people think, okay, these two yoga traditions has a lot of similarities, okay? And has channels, and has chakras, and they work with body energy, they work with channel, and they work with wind energy, okay? But difference between Vajrayana yoga or Yantra yoga and ancient Indian yoga tradition is Vajrayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Yantra Yoga believes in wisdom and enlightenment and reach Buddhahood. And then ancient Indian yoga tradition used that yoga for health and for more world pleasures, really healthy, and work with kundalinis and all these things, right? So maybe from Vajrayana Buddhist tradition, it's not as transcendent.
Yeah, transcendent.
Yeah. But also, of course, in ancient Indian yoga tradition have their own philosophy ideas too. So I don't think it's that important to, okay, what's this relationship, right? Because yoga is yoga. And physical body, if yoga helps physical body and the channels, that's what we need, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I am a weird, so don't think other lama's idea is wrong, and I am more flexible. Don't think that, okay? I'm weird, but I think if something helps our spiritual practice, we shouldn't think this is good or this is bad or this is mine or this is theirs, right? But also, we should know the distinguish and what main practice we are going to do, and what is our goal, what we want, what kind of realization we want to reach, right? Yoga is yoga. And now we do yoga every Sunday. We have a yoga class at the center. I have not taught Vajrayana yoga yet. It's so, you have to be so strong and so flexible. It's not that easy for Western people, Western body, but we use different yoga practice. When David is there and David teaches, and now there's another young David and he give the yoga class, and we, every single session, when before we do the sitting meditation, we do a yoga practice, and then we sit. Right?
Okay, so can I just make two comments on that? One is, The classical yoga system, there's eight limbs, and the physical asana is only one of those eight. Mm-hmm. So classically, they were designed, the other three of the others are all about concentration, meditation, or samadhi, or some mm-hmm. state, a meditative state. Mm-hmm. And so the two were to interweave anyway. And unfortunately, in the West, we're really only picking up the one of those eight limbs, mm-hmm. mostly, and it's starting to move more now into meditation. And it almost seems like the yogic tradition lost the meditation component when it got transported to the West. Like, it's very difficult to find a yoga studio where you could actually engage in a deeper structured meditation practice. So it's happening there to bring that back in some fashion. The objects, as Rinpoche says, are different. When Richard was just here just a while ago, Rinpoche, he said, he gave a talk about Mahayana Buddhism and how they switched over, how the two think. And his comment, which I thought was really beautiful, he says, these two traditions have been stealing from each other for centuries. And he says, one will take from the other, and the other will take from the other. And so really, you know, you're coming at them. But I think the other side of it is, in terms of the motivation that comes out of the Vajrayana practice, it's totally different than in the Hindu and the yogic practice. So that sets it apart, right?
Yeah.
Sets it apart for that.
Yeah.
For those reasons.
Target is different. Goal is different. Mm-hmm. And a lot of yoga practitioners in the West want to be healthy, want to look good. That's all, mm-hmm. right? And not maybe wanting to be able to have some glimpse of realization and transform all emotions into wisdom, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And not believe in enlightenment. A lot of yoga practitioners. So there's that difference.
In the Hindu system, there is a god, right? And there is a religious type of yoga, I forget the name of it. And you are practicing for God or to realize God.
The basic one that I always understand is that there's this idea that there's it's a question of external and internals, but there's always their idea that there's a small self and a super self or an atman, and that the practice of yoga is designed to bring those two together, right? That's the thing. And the other, I don't know if it's the object of the yoga practice is something called it's a release, it's a freedom, right? It doesn't have the same motivation as Rupa Sesha says, it's freedom for all others to actually, you know, that you generate that bodhicitta experience, mm-hmm. so that it's for the benefit of all other beings, but it's generally described as a I just lost the word now. There's a variety of different words for the effect of the practice to be completely liberated, and it's a little bit more along the lines of an individual practice, you know, more of a Hinayana kind of realization as opposed to a deeper practice that takes you further for the benefit of all other beings. But that's just scratching the surface of those things. I've probably said too little or too much. I don't know.
Just in terms of, I think, as Rinpoche was saying, at different lamas have different opinions on that. The Shambhala community, for example, which is Tibetan Buddhist, that the head of the Shambhala lineage, Sakyamuni Rinpoche, practices Hatha Yoga, and he actually worked with the Iyengar family to develop a small yoga sequence that he encourages the Shambhala community to do, and it's done in most of our retreats and so on. So I think it's just an individual.
It's just a spiritual teacher who can adapt other cultures, can be a little bit different. And who cannot adapt or who always grow up in Tibet and lived in Tibet and have not seen different traditions, it's not that easy to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the identity, dharma identity, spiritual identity thing. Just one joke, thank you. Maybe you have a joke.
No. But I heard a good one at lunch.
Okay.
And I can't remember jokes, but the woman who told the joke at lunchtime. She knows herself.
Yes. It's you.
Okay, I have a joke. At least it's a good joke.
So an American came to visit Canada to understand the Canadian culture. And he was going to each province. So he started in British Columbia, and he was downtown in Vancouver, and he saw this telephone. And the telephone had a little note that said, for $10,000, you can speak directly to the divine, to God, to your God, to your divinity. So he thought that was very interesting. So he went to the next province of Canada, Alberta. And again, downtown, he saw in Edmonton, again, the telephone was there, this big phone. And at the top of it, it said, for $10,000, you can speak to your God, your divinity, who is important to you. So he's traveling across Canada, he goes to Ontario, in the same thing, downtown Ottawa, it's a big phone, and you can, for $10,000, you can speak to God. So he's thinking this is really strange, right? Well, who are these Canadians that have this direct line to God? So he goes to Nova Scotia, the same thing. So he has to cross the waters to Newfoundland. And in Newfoundland, he's downtown St. John's, and again, there's this phone. And above the phone it says, for 10 cents, you can speak to God. And he looked at his guide and he said, why in Newfoundland is it only 10 cents to speak to God? He said, because you were already in paradise.
But now you have to change that a little bit.
I know.
And Ottawa, change it into